Garden Basics with Farmer Fred is brought to you by Smart Pots, the original lightweight, long-lasting fabric plant container. It's made in the USA. Visit smartpots.com/Fred for more information and a special discount. That's smartpots.com/Fred. Welcome to the Garden Basics with Farmer Fred podcast. If you're just a beginning gardener or you want good gardening information, well, you've come to the right spot. You know, it's a good thing that Santa parks his sleigh on your rooftop. Otherwise, Rudolph, Donner, Blitzen, and the rest of his deer crew just might help themselves to your garden goodies. Deer love your garden. So is there such a thing as deer-resistant plants? How do you keep deer from ravaging your radishes and rose bushes? We have tips. Plus, we've got advice for caring for that new cut Christmas tree that you're about to haul home. Tips to make it last through the holidays. And you can call it a poinsettia or a poinsettia. We have pointers to help keep that holiday staple of a houseplant looking good. It's episode 64 of the Garden Basics with Farmer Fred podcast, brought to you by Smart Pots. And we'll do it all in under 30 minutes. Let's go. No matter where you go in the United States, you are going to find deer. They're visible, they're widespread, and they love to munch on your garden. They're a very popular game animal, but they're not so fun when they're in your backyard eating your garden, your plants, your annuals, your perennials, your fruit trees, and everything else. And it seems like deer populations are increasing in more populated areas, especially those on the outskirts of town, those that border riparian areas. And they seem to be getting more and more bold going into denser population areas because, let's face it, we're not coyotes. They're not that afraid of us. Deer, how do you protect your plants? Debbie Flower is with us, college professor, retired, of horticulture. And I would think that in your time as a college professor, especially at ones in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada mountains, this question came up a lot.
Yeah, it sure did. There are a lot of vineyards in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada mountains. And for them, it's a big, big problem because deer feed on relatively new growth and they can do a lot of damage, especially if you get a mom who decides your vineyard is a good place to have her babies. Then the babies, yeah, that's their new home and they will come back and come back and come back. So it's definitely a big problem up there.
I think a lot of people have finally realized that you have to take all these deer-proof plant lists with a grain of salt because, like we say, all gardening is local. Well, all deer are local, and they may have different taste buds wherever they may happen to be in the country.
And if they're starving, they'll eat anything, as a human would do. If you're starving, and you'll eat anything to quell your stomach. So that's very true. There is nothing that is truly deer-proof. But there are some strategies we can do to protect the plants that deer love a lot and that we love a lot and hopefully keep the deer from damaging them and keep them maybe out of our garden.
So as we try to do on this program, whenever we're tackling a pest problem is we have to correctly identify the pest. What are the signs that it's deer that are eating your plants?
You're absolutely right. There are other things that could be eating your plants, rodents, rabbits, and deer being among them. And so you need to have an idea of the what we call the signs of deer, the things that let us know the deer have been there. One is the way they eat. Deer don't leave tooth marks on trunks, let's say. You won't see a set of marks in the trunk. They have to eat. They tear the leaves apart or shred them. They don't have upper incisors. I'm not real good on teeth, but those I think are cutting teeth. Deer lack upper incisors, so they can't just bite into something like biting into an apple. They have to grab onto the nice young stems and leaves and tear them off. So that's number one, the type of damage you see. The location of that damage. Deer are much taller than other things that might be eating our plants from the ground, like rabbits and rodents. So the damage could go up the plant to 4 to 5 feet, maybe even bigger if you've got bigger deer around. Then look down, look at the ground, look for their poop, the deer pellets. I'm sure you can find pictures on the internet, so I'm not going to describe them.
They're black and round.
They're black and round. Yeah, and shiny.
Yeah.
And in a pile, usually. And then their hooves. They have two, I guess it's called a cloven hoof, two indents in the ground. And the whole thing is kind of the shape of an avocado or an egg. Hmm. And that's the deer imprint in the ground. So you're going to look for those things.
It's probably the size of two pennies together placed end to end.
From the tip of each clove to the back, right? That's
right.
What you're saying?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they're, you know, it's not that big. You would think with a deer that there might be a bigger footprint, but in reality, it's fairly compact.
It is quite small, yes.
So, okay, we've figured out it's the deer, but we should point out, too, that male deer, especially in late summer, may be rubbing their antlers on tree trunks and limbs or fence posts. And usually if it's a mature tree, it's not that much of damage. But if they're rubbing those antlers on smaller trees or saplings, then there could be a lot of damage.
Right. If there's not a lot of cork over the live part of the plant. So cork is what we typically call bark. And the live part of the plant is just underneath that. And that's where all the liquids move around in the plant. If there's not a lot of protection over that, the wet part, it rips it right off and exposes the vascular system of the plant. So yeah, that's a very, the deer are trying to take the velvet off of their antlers when they're doing that.
I think for the sake of this discussion, we will limit the conversation about deer-proof plants simply because it isn't consistent from one area of the country to another. So let's talk about exclusion or modification or a lot of interesting things you can buy at the nursery too to maybe dissuade deer.
Right. There are several categories that we can explore for protecting our garden. As you mentioned, exclusion, modifying the habitat, repellents, and hazing or frightening them. And then in most places where there are deer, there is a hunting season as well. The most effective of all of those, but probably the most expensive of all of those controls is the fencing. And that was something that was explored heavily in the vineyards in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada. It's expensive to make a fence and put it up, and it has to be minimum of 6 feet. 8 feet is better, and has to go all the way around the property, no holes in it. And deer will also, if they can, they'll go under the fence. So you have to be sure that fence is attached to the ground somehow. If it's a rigid fence, that's fine, but it is less expensive and maybe easier to use. Some of the softer plastics that are woven and rolled up and used as fencing around, let's say, construction sites, that might be a place you'd see them. They need to be 6 feet tall, minimum 8 feet is better. And they need to be rigidly attached so that the deer can't get under them or over is because of the height. They can't get over them.
Yeah, or they have to be rigidly supported, too, so they don't knock down the fence, too. So you're going to have your support posts much closer together than you would on a normal fence.
Right, right. So that it's a pricey way to go. Electric fences are a possibility, too. And I read many different cooperative extension sites about deer, and some of them you could tell deer was a really big problem because they suggested turning on your electric fence and then getting a piece of aluminum foil, putting peanut butter on it and wrapping it around the live electric fence so that the deer would be attracted and they would get there zapping. That is an extreme, I think. And electric fences take real regular maintenance because a lot of things can cause that electricity to fail.
Right. I think a good point, too, that University of California Cooperative Extension makes about if you are constructing a deer fence is not only are you trying to keep them from getting in, you've got to give them an easy way to get out.
Yes.
And that's, yes, I would think, very important that if you spot a deer in a fenced garden, then if you go to try to get them out, they may end up destroying the fence trying to get out.
Right. And they're not going to come to you asking you to open the gate.
No, they're not.
So you need to have another place. Fences, you need to fence the entire property and it needs to have a gate. The gate needs to be the same height as the fence. And you probably need a back door so that if you go in your gate and close it behind you, because the deer may come in when you're not looking and see a deer, you can leave by that gate and go around. The gate is typically in a place, or often in a place where humans hang out, the deer is not likely to head toward that main gate. So have a back door, have a back gate where they can leave.
Hmm. And I imagine, too, on a slope, you would want that escape gate on the high end.
It probably depends on your property, but that sounds like a really good idea. There's lots of discussion, and there was some practice of it in the foothills, of using a slanted fence. Deer can jump high and they can jump far, but they can't do both at the same time. And so if you only have a 6-foot fence, one technique is to slant it away at about a 45-degree angle, away from the plant you're trying to protect at about a 45-degree angle. And that combination of distance and height will flummox the deer and keep them out.
Mm. Now, I've heard, too, of experiments going on with even shorter fences of 4 and 5 foot heights, but having that second sloping fence pointed outward as well, sort of like forming a V, if you will. And as long as they can't get between the two fences and then jump, you might have success keeping them out with a lower fence by having the double fencing.
Right. I also saw double fencing of vertical fences and a dog run between them. So how wide is a dog run? 3 foot, 4 foot. And so the second fence inside didn't need to be as high. It just needed to contain the dog. And the deer don't like dogs, so dogs can be used as protection. But of course, you need to take care of that dog then. That's not a free thing. You feed it, take it to the vet, groom it, all of those good things.
We're glad to have SmartPots on board supporting the Garden Basics podcast. SmartPots are the original award-winning fabric planter. They're sold worldwide. SmartPots are proudly made 100% in the USA. I'm pretty picky about who I allow to advertise on this program. My criteria, though, is pretty simple. It has to be a product I like, a product I use, a product I would buy again. And SmartPots clicks all those boxes. They're durable, they're reusable. SmartPots are available at independent garden centers and select Ace and True Value stores nationwide. To find a store near you, visit smartpots.com/Fred. It's SmartPots, the original award-winning fabric planter. Go to smartpots.com/Fred for more info and that special Farmer Fred discount on your next SmartPot purchase. Go to smartpots.com/Fred. Let's get back to our conversation with Debbie Flower, ways to keep deer out of your garden. Well, that brings up then the thought of using repellents, and there are all sorts of chemical repellents that are sold for reducing or preventing deer damage. But I think they're only good until it starts raining.
Right. Repellents are a temporary solution. If you've got a crop that is just coming ripe and you realize a deer has found it and is starting to eat it, and you're only going to need this deer protection for a short period of time, then a repellent is a possibility. There are lots of recipes for making repellents. They need to either smell really bad, like fermented egg, or they need to cause a discomfort to the deer after they've been eaten, and that would be like hot pepper, the capsaicin in hot pepper. There are anecdotal repellents like hanging hair in the crop or hanging using urine of which you'd have to buy, of a predator of the deer. Those are also suggested, but not tested.
I'm just wondering how they collect urine from coyotes.
Yeah, I'm not sure I want to know.
Yeah, okay.
I assume it's manufactured, you know, that somebody's analyzed what's in coyote urine and then put the same chemicals together. But that's my guess.
Now, what about frightening devices, noisy objects? You see advertised a lot of motion-activated sprinklers. But again, I would think at some point they will just say, oh, it's raining, and keep
right
on eating.
Yes, it doesn't. They're, again, short term. When you put them out, initially they will keep the deer away. Again, you could use them potentially for a crop that just has a few days to go before you're going to finish with it. And the one you're talking about raining, that would be a motion activated sprinkler. Other hazing things would be noises, radios, dog barking, setting off blanks on some kind of a weapon, a gun kind of thing. but the deer will get used to them. So they're not very effective. One thing a friend of mine did in her home garden, and she lived near in the Napa Sonoma area, was made a very narrow garden, only about 5 feet wide, and fenced just that area. And because it was so narrow, the deer could not jump into it. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Okay. And so they're not willing to do a 6 foot leap into an area that they may not clear.
Right. Right. So that kept them out.
But does that work from the get go, or do deer learn that after Cousin Jim gets stuck at the top of the fence?
Yeah, I don't know about that for sure, but I would discourage people from putting anything harmful on the top of the fence. You don't want to kill the deer. They talk about wire fencing because it has some flexibility to it, and it is easier to release a deer that gets caught in it, or the deer to release themselves. Not to use barbed wire, because you're just creating the barrier. You're not trying to harm the deer in the process.
I guess another solution for people who just want to protect certain valuable plants, and I'm thinking of fruit trees, would be to individually cage each of these fruit trees. And this goes back to something we've talked about a lot on this program, maintaining fruit trees at a height that are within your reach. In other words, keeping them at maybe 6 feet tall or so and 6 feet wide. And that way, you'll still have plenty of fruit for the family, but it'd be much easier to build an enclosure to protect that tree.
Right. That's definitely an option. And also a young tree, we were talking about the male deer coming along and rubbing their antlers on a tree. And if it's a young tree with a narrow stem, then it's much more damaging to that than an older tree that has much more, much wider stem and much more cork on the outside of that wood. So the trunk of the tree can be covered either with a very narrow fence, it's only a foot or two across, and just prevents the deer from getting up close to it and rubbing their antlers against it. Or you can use something like a tree wrap, a plastic tree wrap, or a tree shelter, something netting over the tree, something like that, that would keep the deer away. It is not a permanent solution, and it shouldn't be. Those kinds of things that are very small and close to the trunk need to be checked regularly so the plant itself is not damaged. So they're just for starting up, for getting the orchard going, let's say, and then considering doing the fencing that you were talking about next.
And if you're thinking of using some sort of noisemaker to frighten them off, I love this sentence in the University of California information on deer and their pests in the gardens and landscape series. And it says there about if you're thinking of using noisemakers, well, in urban and suburban residential areas, deer come into contact with a variety of changing auditory and visual stimuli daily and often quickly habituate to things that cause them no harm. So, for instance, I was on my bicycle today and I happened to be going down Sunrise Boulevard, which is a very busy street here in the Sacramento area. Four lanes of traffic, always traffic. Lots of signals, lots of horns. And here's a family of deer just walking down the sidewalk of Sunrise Boulevard.
Headed
for a residential complex where they had spied some tasty shrubs.
Oh, my goodness. Yes. Yes. I've seen them, but not in such such busy places. But they were on the side of the road, and it was a family and of many sizes. There were probably seven or so deer. And they actually stopped and waited for the car to go by.
Yeah, I noticed these deer I saw today, they crossed with the light. Whatever. I think they've done this before.
Yeah, they've gotten to know their environment. So, yeah, this noise stuff, they call it hazing in one website I saw. It doesn't work.
it's very temporary. I guess if you mix it up a bit, that might help. But again, it will be short term. So is there a solution? Maybe.
No.
Maybe not. No.
not a end all be all solution. We can't eradicate the deer or the damage they're going to do, but we can share with them. And I didn't see anybody saying anything about that. If you have enough property, you can put something that they like to eat way out in the back 40 somewhere. And obviously they'll still come looking for what else you have, but that you would have to protect. And exclusion is your best choice. Fencing.
Exclusion is it. Deer, they are among us, and we will continue to protect our backyard food supply. Yep. Debbie Flower, college horticulture professor, retired. Thank you so much for telling us the truth about deer.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you, Fred.
Well, it's a beautiful November day. We're up at Isley's Nursery in Auburn, and they're having an open house. And what we're staring at are tables and tables of beautiful poinsettias. Isley's is known in the fall for their collection of poinsettias. In the spring, they're known for their tomatoes. But right now, we're talking with Bill Isley. And Bill, these are gorgeous poinsettias. How many varieties do you have here?
Now you got me.
All right. I'll start with an easier question.
Yeah, there's two different types of red. And then we have the Jingle Bells, Orange Feist, Mayonnaise, Ice Punch, Pinks, about 9 different varieties.
And, of course, I imagine in the spring these all become tomatoes.
Yes, this will be the vegetable production house.
Right. How long have you been propagating and growing poinsettias?
My father and uncle started doing the poinsettias in the early 70s. I took over production of the poinsettias in 1978.
A while then.
A couple of years.
Yeah, a couple of years. Local nurseries love your product. They love the poinsettias because they're healthy. They grow well, just like your tomatoes.
Yes, they do. So we ship, you know, to other nurseries, to the florists here in Northern California and Western Nevada.
Yeah, it's interesting to see a poinsettia production going on here in Northern California. You tend to think of this as a Southern California institution, but if, as long as you got poly roofs and probably a large PG&E bill, you can get away with it.
Yes, we can. PG&E loves us.
All right. It's mostly gas heat, I would think.
Yes, all gas heat. And then in the summer, we have these big draft fans and then the cooling pads, just like an old swamp cooler to cool the houses down to keep them at temperature.
And, of course, these will be gone probably by mid-December?
Yes, around December 15th, except for there are some churches that wait till the 20th or so of December before they take theirs.
All right. And these are in some very nice pots here. You got all of these in ceramic pots.
Yeah. Yep, they're all in clay pots. We are one of the last ones to do them in clay pots. But since I sell to nurseries and florists, we don't want it to look like mass marketers, so we stay with the clay instead of the plastic.
It's excellent. It's just fantastic here. I mean, I don't think I've ever seen so many poinsettias in one place. Are you unique to growing this in Northern California? Maybe over in the Bay Area there might be some.
There's still quite a few poinsettia growers here in Northern California. Lodi, Galt, over on the Half Moon Bay and stuff. So there's still quite a few of us growing.
Give us some care tips for poinsettias.
You want to keep them away from drafts, away from the front door, away from any heaters, any wood heaters if you're heating with wood, and you want to keep them in filtered light away from a window. Like on your dining room table, it's perfect.
All right, and they're good till what, February or so?
Yes, they should last you at least until Valentine's Day if you're taking good care of them.
And I imagine at least once a day somebody comes up to you and says, now, how can I get this to last all year?
Every day.
Every day.
They do. Yeah. You can't get it to stay in color year-round. It is going to revert back to green, and then you have to start the process all over, where you're cutting it back to get new shoots, and then it's water, temperature, and fertilization to get it to come back into color.
Not to mention a long period of darkness.
They're not as much as the old varieties. Mm. The new varieties, they actually light up. Mm. And we have enough ambient light coming in from around the nursery. I do not light them because it's more of a dull color. They do not have the vibrant color if you light them or use black cloth. So we just use natural light.
All right. So for those attempting to, shall we say, oversummer their poinsettias and get them to rebloom or to recolor, because we should point out, and we haven't done that yet, that the actual flower of the plant is this center part.
Center part.
The cyathea.
Yes. The bract is what colors up, and it is not the flower.
Right. The bract is a modified leaf, and people say, oh, what beautiful flowers, when in reality, it's a beautiful leaf.
It's a beautiful bract. Yes, the leaf.
Pests of poinsettias. I don't see any whiteflies here. Congratulations.
Thank you. We are on the whiteflies all the time. We do two treatments. We have lucked out this year with the whiteflies, but they're more susceptible now to root rots than what they used to be. That is our big thing. I'm actually been treating the poinsettias every 15 days for root rot.
Well, that would be another cultural tip then, is for people, don't put them in pots without drainage. They need good drainage.
They have to have good drainage, and you let it dry out before you water it again.
Right.
You do not want to keep it wet all the time.
Poinsettias, it's a beautiful plant for the fall. They do so well here. They're everywhere, and they're up here in Auburn. Thank you, Bill.
Thank you.
If you're going to be visiting a choose and cut Christmas tree farm, or maybe a nursery or supermarket or hardware store, or for that matter, a corner lot that may already be filled with chopped cedars, pines, and firs, here are some tips from the Michigan State University Cooperative Extension Department of Horticulture and Forestry to keep that Christmas tree, your December living room centerpiece, intact through the holidays. For one thing, you want to keep that Christmas tree looking good for several weeks. So when you get that tree home, don't immediately put it in the house unless it's the day before Christmas. Place the tree in a cool, sheltered location until a few days before Christmas, such as an unheated garage or carport. Otherwise, the warm, dry air of your living room or den can hasten needle drop. Storing it in an environment that more resembles a forest as long as possible will keep those branches more pliable. When you get the tree home, remove a half inch to a 1 inch cut at the base, then immediately plunge that base into a large container of water. If that tree is going to be outside for many days, make another base cut of about a half inch, ideally every day, to keep the water flowing into the tree to keep the needles fresh looking. By the way, washing the tree off with a hose can help dislodge any hitchhiking pests. You should have checked for that when you were picking it out at the nursery. Before bringing the tree indoors, shake it vigorously to dislodge any loose needles, or for that matter, any hitchhiking bugs that you don't want to bring inside. And you may want to check for ants, too, before you bring it indoors. Now, before you set up that Christmas tree in its permanent, well, semi-permanent home in the living room, make a fresh, straight cut across the base of the tree of about an inch and place the tree in a stand that holds a gallon of water or more when the tree is in it. But remember that that tree is going to displace a lot of water in that base. So that base should probably have a capacity of 2 gallons or more. The water capacity listed on a stand's label or box can be rather misleading. Usually, they list the capacity of the reservoir when the stand is empty, but you need to allow for water that's going to be displaced when that tree trunk is put in the stand. Cut Christmas trees will absorb a surprising amount of water, particularly during their first week indoors. As a rule, for each inch of stem diameter, the tree will probably need a quart of water per day. Check your tree stand daily to make sure the container has enough water. Refill it often to make sure the water doesn't fall below the level of the trunk bottom. Now, what about additives? There's plenty of additives that you can add to Christmas tree water in the belief that it's going to make the tree last longer. Many university studies have been done in Washington and North Carolina, as well as Michigan. Their results? Plain water is best. Some home concoctions, such as bleach and aspirin, can cause heavy needle loss, and those should be avoided. Just use clean water, and plenty of it. It's the only essential ingredient for maintaining tree freshness. And as any longtime Christmas tree setter-upper can tell you, don't forget that low-hanging ornaments on a Christmas tree are an enticing cat toy. You'll realize that when you hear a crashing sound in the middle of the night. Be sure to check today's show notes for more information about deer fencing, deer repellents, poinsettia plants, and Christmas tree care. It's all in today's show notes. The Garden Basics podcast is going to a winter schedule, maybe just like your favorite local nursery. November through January, Garden Basics will come out once a week on Fridays. Then, as the weather warms back up in February, we'll return to our twice-a-week schedule. Thank you for listening, subscribing, and leaving comments. We appreciate that you've included us in your garden life.